You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
All right, today we got Mark Kurlansky with us, and Mark is the author of a brand new book, To Catch a Fish, by Story Publishing, March 31st, 2026. That's today as we're recording. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
Mark, I've been reading your stuff for darn near 30 years, I think.
Oh, my.
Yeah, came across a book that you might probably are best well known for called Cod, and I thought it was just a magnificent history, a biography of the fish, I think you call it.
You know, you've got your timing exactly right, because this year, a 30-year anniversary edition of Cod is coming out.
Is that right? Well, we'll have to publicize that here too. So, but yeah, like I said, today we're talking about To Catch a Fish, and you've written a number of books on fishing, fly fishing specifically. You're a former commercial fisherman in an old life, it sounds like, huh?
In my youth.
In your youth, yeah. And and then you've also, another one of my major interests is baseball, and I wanted to talk quick before we get into this book today, but you wrote a book that blew my mind called Eastern Stars, and it was,
yeah,
and it was a history of baseball in the Dominican Republic, particularly about the Eastern Stars or Estrellas Orientales and the town of San Pedro de Macorís, the cradle of shortstops. How did you think to write that book?
Well, it was kind of an evolution. I spent a lot of time in the Caribbean. I covered the Caribbean for the Chicago Tribune for about 10 years. And, I had always wanted to write a book about a Caribbean town. And then I started thinking about this particular town that had produced so many Major League Baseball players. And I thought this would be a great town to write about.
Yeah. And yeah, that dovetails with, you know, my interests, which are, you know, primarily baseball and fly fishing. So it's wonderful to have you on here. And, yeah. And so, this book recently released, To Catch a Fish, it's not a specifically a fly fishing book, but you talk about fly fishing a lot. How did you get into fly fishing to begin with?
Well, I didn't start with fly fishing.
Like most of us.
Right. I started as a little kid with a worm. and then I went from there, like a lot of people do in New England, where I'm from. If you don't happen to own a boat, you become a surf caster. And I did surf casting for a lot of years. And, you know, boat fishing, all kinds of fishing when I had the opportunity. And bit by bit, I started experimenting with fly fishing. And, you know, it just...
consumes you.
It does. I was trying to avoid saying it hooks you, you know. yeah, I mean, it's the most challenging way to fish, and so it's the most interesting.
Yeah, and when I was reading your book, and you talk about, you know, all the different species of fish you can catch, particularly in fly fishing, and you have a section there about striped bass fishing, but I think when most of us, or most people, not necessarily me, but most people, when they think about fly fishing, they think about trout fishing. And you dedicate a good amount of time. Would you agree with that assessment? I think, is all fly fishing kind of couched in trout fishing and then expands from
there? Well, that or salmon.
Salmon, yeah.
I mean, fly fishing for salmon is a great experience, both Pacific species and Atlantic salmon.
Yeah, and I come from the Northwest originally, Oregon. And
oh, well, then you know salmon fishing, right?
I don't really fly fish for salmon, but I fly fish for trout, particularly rainbow trout and steelhead.
And right.
I have fly fish for Atlantic salmon, but as you mentioned in the book, you know, in North America anymore, there's not many left.
In Europe either.
Yeah, right. All around there, you know, you see a lot of salmon at the stores. Atlantic salmon in the stores is all farmed.
It is all farm, no matter what they tell you. I don't think there's any legal commercial fishery for Atlantic salmon anymore.
Yeah, unless it's down in South America where they're not native.
Right.
Yeah, I had a chance to go to the Gaspé Peninsula about 20 years ago for about a week fishing for Atlantic salmon, and I hooked one in that entire week. That was exciting enough, I guess.
Well, I'll tell you something. I fished for Atlantic salmon in a number of places, and all total, you know how many I've caught? One.
One. Landed one, huh?
I landed one in Scotland.
Oh, wow. That's the birthplace.
And what really struck me was that everybody I knew in Scotland was sending emails about it.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was unusual enough to talk about.
Yeah. And you, early on in this book, you talk about fish just in general, and don't have the exact quote, but you talk about them being smart and fish being smart. And you have a prescription at the tail end of the book about how a fish should avoid being caught. But
yes, I hope fish read this book so that they can avoid.
Exactly. Yeah. Why not? But you talk about them being smart.
When I do a lot of catch and release.
Yeah. Yeah. As do I.
When I release a fish, when I put it back in the river, I always say, and let that be a lesson to you.
Yeah, there you go. You talk about the fish being smart. And I was, you know, in the fly fishing industry for years, did retail, was a guide, worked for several companies around that. But I got turned on to the idea, you know, because I grew up thinking, oh, these fish are so smart, you know, they're so wily. But there was a fellow named Gary Borger. He's a scientist. I think he was at Penn State University at one time. He was actually the consultant, I think, to Robert Redford on A River Runs Through It, who you mentioned this book and the movie toward the end. But he said they can't be smart. Their brains are the size of pencil erasers.
Well, but the rest of them isn't that big either. Come on.
So, yeah, right. Yeah. So anyway, that, you know, I think it's splitting hairs a little bit, but you know, I think we project a lot upon these wonderful animals that we fish for.
We do, but you know, there's some things that they do that you just have to wonder. Like the way
you do.
If you're fighting a sockeye salmon and you finally get it to the point where you've just about got it to the net and it kind of looks up and turns around and darts out to sea again, you think, you know, this animal is thinking.
No, they're wonderful. And, you know, my life has been fishing, like I said, like fishing and baseball for the most part. Those are the real passions in my life. And, you know,
those are the two important things.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk about a little bit about the literature that you mention in the book. Let's talk first maybe about A River Runs Through It. You more or less toward the end of the book. This book was just so revolutionary. I don't actually know about the book. The book came out in, what, 1976, almost 50 years ago. But then the movie came out in the early 90s.
Yeah, you know, Redford wanted to do it, and McLean, the author, didn't want him to, and fought him for a long time, and finally said, okay, go ahead and do it. And, you know, he died before the movie came out.
Right. I didn't realize that there was a little tension there, but I was listening to a podcast with Tom McGuane, who you also mention in the book.
Right.
You know, a famous writer and angler himself. And he said, it was a podcast with Andy Mill, and he told Andy that he gave the book to Redford originally, because I think Redford wanted to do something about the West and the wild of the West. You know, he's getting into Sundance and all that stuff. But anyway, he gave him the book. And like I said, Borger was the consultant there. But Gary's son, Jason, was the stunt double for Brad Pitt. And apparently Brad Pitt can't fish worth a lick. So none of that stuff was Brad Pitt. It was all Jason Borger.
But that's okay, because, you know, you really can't catch a trout that way.
No, and that's what I wanted to get to.
Fantastic cast, you know?
Yeah.
They look great in the movie, but that's not how you do it.
That's what I wanted to get to, and I think people coming to fly fishing brand new, they see this movie, which is an iconic movie, and they see the guy casting, you know, the beautiful cast, and he's not tangled and all this stuff. And, you know, of course he, in the book and in the movie, they talk about like how he has to wave it around to look like a salmon fly or stone fly or whatever it is. You know, it's a bunch of hogwash, because you just want your fly in the water as much as possible to catch fish.
The trout isn't looking up at the sky to watch the flight patterns of the insect.
Exactly. When I started doing this and I saw people, you know, they're whipping the fly around, I was like, no.
I often wonder about that, if people see that movie and then start casting like that.
It's absolutely true, but they have no way. They don't know how to cast, and then they try and do this fancy shadow casting, and guess what happens? Well, you get all sorts of knots and tangles in your line. What happens when you have a knot in your leader? Well, you get a fish on and it breaks off.
Right. The only time you do a cast anything like that is if you're fishing with a dry fly and the fly gets too wet.
Sure.
And you want to whip it around in the air a little bit to dry it off. But that's not how you'll catch a fish.
Yeah, when I was guiding, I was like, I got so frustrated with this. Like, why do people do this? You know, like,
because they saw the movie.
They saw the movie, right? And so, you know, they're out here with the brand new rod, brand new reel, brand new fly line, brand new waders, all this stuff. But they can't fish worth a lick. And it's like, no, I'll just show you. Put the fly here, flip it out, and you don't have to cast very far, and you'll catch some fish. But they, of course, people continue to want to do that.
Yeah, I would just say though that it's a lovely movie.
It is a lovely movie, and
it doesn't teach you how to fly fish, but it teaches you why.
Correct. And with this whole shadow casting and all that stuff, I developed what I call O'Leary's first law of fly fishing, and I said, "Thou cannot cast thyself out of a tangle." So I see people like, "Oh no. We're tangled up. Let me just try and finish the cast." Well, no, you have to stop and untangle yourself because you're in a mess. And the fish, inevitably, whether they're smart or not, whenever you get a fish on, just as or if you are in a tangle, the fish start rising and jumping and they're hopping all around you. And the timing of this thing is quite unique. But
I always think, and this is probably just my imagination, but when trout start jumping up like that, I think they're making fun of me.
Yeah, all of
them. They're just laughing at me.
You talk in the book, you have a big section, and I actually wrote I was telling my wife this after I read your book, or actually right as soon as I got the book, I turned it to the index and the bibliography, and I'm like, man, he reads a lot of the books, or a lot of books that I've read. So I wrote this paper in college, The History of Fly Fishing. And I was like, geez, did he copy my bibliography from 25 years ago or whatever it was? And there's a lot of the same books, but a lot of these books that you have in your bibliography are foundational texts to the entire sport.
Right.
But one book you mentioned, it was, oh gosh, about women in fly fishing, Lila Foggia, I think. She's from Oregon too, I believe. But I read that one, and we don't have a ton of women in the sport. But you give pretty thorough women, influential women in the sport of fly fishing, and how they have really developed a lot of the creature comforts.
Yeah, and you know, Orvis and a lot of the people in the industry now say that the fastest growing demographic in fly fishing is women.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. When I was involved, there were like clubs, like women's fly fishing clubs. And I took this group of, I don't know, like 10 women out learning how to fly fish. And, I, you know, probably a percentage wise, this just goes with any demographic. A few of them continue, but it was pretty neat to see them all together. But one thing that I learned that you didn't have in here, because you talked about the waders and, you know, how like women want to be comfortable. Of course, we all want to be comfortable. So all this equipment comes from wanting to be more comfortable, as opposed to having galoshes and all this stuff. But the fishing rods, or fly rods maybe specifically, the grips used to be made of rattan, from what I understand. And there were so many women getting involved in fishing. Whenever they did this change, they said, I need something softer on my hand. So then now we have cork on our handles. And thank you, women of fly fishing, for that, because I can't imagine holding a rattan handle all day long.
Right. And also some lighter rods.
Lighter rods. Exactly. Oh, I was going to say Joan Wolfe. She is so influential and perhaps in the general public, not given enough credit because she was a wonderful fly caster, obviously the wife of the great Lee Wolfe, but she created this fly casting. It's almost like a toy, but it's not a toy. It's a tool to learn how to cast with just a small lightweight rod and a piece of yarn to make sure that you get your loops right. And we have one here at the house for the boys. So, and my daughter.
Yeah, but she came from a dancing background.
That's what you mentioned. I was not aware of that before I read.
Yeah. And you know, I saw that work because, my daughter was a dancer from a very young age. She started in ballet. And, I mean, you taught her a cast. You didn't even have to show it to her. You just explained it. And she did it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And she understood the rhythm of it and the balance of it. And, you know, dance is a great background for fly fishing.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I mean, what you mentioned in the book is that it teaches one or the woman or the girl in particular, but any dancer, how to use your entire body to do these magnificent feats that, you know, you think like, oh, cast 100 feet or cast 200 feet. Like this little person can't do this. You have this big hulking human being. It's no, you really don't. You have to harness all your body's capability. And, you know, some of the best fly casters are relatively slight people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my fantasy is to have been able to one day go fly fishing with Nureyev. With Rudolf Nureyev, the great dancer.
Okay.
I don't know if he probably never did go fly fishing, but
we're going to get right back to the show in a second here, folks, but I need to stop and ask you a direct question. You're listening to this show for a number of reasons, but you probably know that this modern economy, which we talk a lot about under Substack, briandoleary.substack.com, you know that this economy is a bare knuckle brawl. You know, the corporate algorithms, the bureaucrats, and all the tech giants, they want you broke, dependent, and begging for permission to run your business. We're not them. So what are you going to do about it? Well, if you're still waiting for the market to be fair, you're going to get knocked out. You need absolute ownership of your platform. And that's what I'm trying to do here with podcasts, emails, Substacks, all of it. You need a fortress. So my solution? I have exactly 2 slots left for the April platform domination consults. Costs $297. We get on the phone or Zoom. We map out your empire. We find the hidden money you're leaving on the table. People have helped me do this. I'm paying it forward. So this is not a chat to coddle you. It is a battle plan. And if we end up working together long term, well, that $297, it'll be credited straight to your balance. So stop making excuses. Go to briandoleary.com/domination. That's briandoleary.com/domination right now and secure your slot before your competitors do. Now back to Mark Kurlansky.
I think if you just gave him a few pointers, he probably would have been incredible.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, with fishing, there's people that really enjoy it. And there's people that don't care, but I don't know. Is it Americans or Westerners or something? There's something about the rivers and a lot of the places we all grow up. People are aware of just fishing in general. It is ubiquitous, even though maybe fly fishing is a very specific skill. Did you come across that or have any comments on the ubiquitousness of fishing in the culture?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's in all cultures, except for certain
Buddhists
who think it's immoral. I was in Tibet, and I saw some great rivers there. And I thought, no one's ever fished these rivers because it's not allowed. Can I just sneak out one day and fish one of these rivers? I bet it would be fantastic. I didn't know.
Yeah, you talk a lot about one chapter in particular about the Irish, and I myself being of Irish extraction, I appreciated that quite a bit. You talk about Yeats, who I hadn't read a whole lot of, but you also talk about Morris Walsh and his fishing stories. And he was a guy.
Have you read them?
I haven't. It was.
Oh, read it. Read it.
I will. And I was going to get to that.
It is so fantastic. And I have to tell you, it is so Irish, you know?
Yeah. And so I was going to say, like, throughout this book, it's a set, a bunch of small, short essays, really, I guess is how you would describe your book. But it's not like one of these fishing books that I grew to despise, where they would write these flowing, flowery essays about the sport. No, you're just telling me how it is and what it is. And so what I liked about this, when you talked about the Irish culture around fishing and fly fishing in particular, is that it gave me a lot of resources to go back to. And, you know, because I say, like, oh, I just checked out your bibliography. I read almost all those books. And then I got to thinking after reading, it's like, just when you think you've read a lot, you realize you haven't read very much. And so this book is full of not only resources, but your take on what these resources, and I appreciate you talking about Walsh, because he also wrote The Quiet Man, which is one of my favorite John Wayne movies.
Although quite different from the story.
Oh, yeah.
In the story, he is Irish. He's Republican, even, and he returned to Ireland to fight, and he's not a heavyweight, and so his would-be brother-in-law is kind of a heavyweight, but the thing is, he knew how to box. But it's just all about fishing, you know. I remember the moment where I realized I loved Ireland.
And have you gone fishing over there?
I have, yeah. In the Blackwater River in County Cork.
Oh, wow.
Big Salmon River. But I was in Galway,
mm-hmm.
At a pub, talking with some marine biologists, because I was writing a book about salmon. And so we're in the pub drinking, you know, Guinness after Guinness.
Good man.
And what did they, I mean, they got into this great debate about fishing and about what flies on that local river. And then from there, it went on to a discussion of dogs. And from there, it went on to a discussion about literature,
uh-huh.
poetry. And I thought, people who love poetry, dogs, and fishing, this is a great country, you know? And one of my favorite lines in this book is not about fishing, but about Irish poets. And so the poets are to Ireland what cheese is to France.
That's true, yeah. I went to Boston College.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And we had, I wasn't fortunate enough to take his class because it filled up way too soon, but Seamus Heaney, the famous Irish poet,
yeah,
taught at least one semester, came over and, you know, taught for a few weeks or something. I think there was another professor he had a poem that I really liked about trout. And actually, believe it or not, took a class learning Irish, the language. And we had to write a poem in that class. And I wrote a poem about a rainbow trout. I was about 20 years old. And I wrote this poem in Irish. I have it somewhere. But I didn't really know the language, right? I was essentially translating, and I wrote my English poem, then tried to translate it, and I didn't think it was very good. But man, the teacher was like, can I take this and use this for my class? I'm like, yeah, sure, fine, whatever. So I don't know whatever happened to that poem, but it's around here somewhere.
Well, you know, rainbow trouts aren't Irish, though.
Well, I was...
You should have done a brown trout.
I think I was... Yeah, it was maybe just about a trout, but I was thinking rainbow trout because that's where I'm from.
Right.
From the Northwest.
Well, you know, they planted rainbow trout everywhere in the world. They were originally only in certain Western rivers, and it is one of the all-time greatest fly fishing targets.
They're everywhere now. I think you mentioned 50 states. I'm like, what about Hawaii? I don't know.
Yeah,
there's a place in, like, isn't it the island of Kauai that you can go rainbow trout fishing?
Yes.
Something like that.
But, you know, in Vermont, I fished in Vermont, and nobody wants to catch the local fish.
The brook trout.
The brookies. Everybody's disappointed when they get a brookie because they want a rainbow. The rainbows aren't from there. The brookie is the local trout. It gets no respect at all.
Yeah. Tis the way of things. I think it's the McLeod River rainbow trout was the most, because they're bigger than, say, the desert red bands of Oregon and stuff. But man, I think you mentioned in the book somewhere that pound for pound, the rainbow trout is the hardest fighting fish or the best fighting fish or something. Something I would absolutely agree with.
Yeah.
I tell people about a 14, 15 inch rainbow trout. You can't beat it for fun.
Oh yeah. I've fished in Russia, in the Kamchatka.
Sure.
And they have huge rainbow trout, and they also have salmon. And it's kind of hard to tell when you first get a hit on your line if you've got a trout or a salmon, because those trout are so strong.
I was fishing for salmon up in Alaska, and I, with a two-hander, like 7-weight two-handed rod, I think it was, and I got this fish on, and good grief, it was probably like a 24-inch rainbow trout, you know, thick as, and I thought it was like one of the biggest accomplishments, because, you know, steelhead fishing in Oregon or Washington, like that's a pretty good sized fish.
So right.
Small for a steelhead, but it's still a pretty good sized fish. I was like, this is just a rainbow trout. This is what lives in the river here? Good grief.
Right. Yeah. No, Alaska's fantastic. Those rivers. I love the way those rivers have these virgin banks, you know, just wild.
Yeah. You talk about Kamchatka too. I mean, I don't know if you mentioned in the book, but man, a friend of mine had guided over there for a few years, and then I clearly can't do that now because of the political situation, but he's just,
I don't know. I think maybe the whole fishing thing in Russia has shut down.
Yeah. I think you're right.
It's too bad. It was an incredible experience. They take you up into these remote areas in forgotten old Red Army helicopters. These ancient, huge helicopters that the Red Army used to use to deploy troops. They take you into the wilds.
We talk a lot about fly fishing in the book, but it's not everything you talk about in the book.
No, I even get into commercial fishing. I love commercial fishing.
So how did you get into that?
Well...
needed a job, paid the money.
I needed a job, and I had this idea, because I always wanted to be a writer, and I always had this idea that if I wanted to be a writer, I should do interesting things. So when I first graduated from high school, I was 17 years old, and I thought it would be an interesting thing to get a job as a commercial fisherman. And it was great.
And where did you go out of? Gloucester or
no? Fisher's Island.
Okay.
And we go and we fish, really off of Rhode Island, the trenches off of Rhode Island.
And what type of fish were you catching there typically? Bluefish?
Well, the job I had was lobster.
Oh, lobster. You were a lobsterman.
Right. But then I experimented. I did a little bit of other stuff, bottom dragging, stuff like that. But I mainly worked on lobster boats.
Oh, wow.
And I have a book coming out next year on lobsters.
Okay.
It's a very personal book. I have a deep personal relationship with lobsters.
I believe it. Yeah. And yeah, you mentioned lobster a little bit in the book. You talk about how, you know, it's interesting. I remember when I first got into fly fishing, the striped bass were, I don't know if they were endangered. They might have been. They've made a major comeback. However, it's huge in Massachusetts down to, say, Virginia or the Carolinas. It's really big there. However, you go up north to Maine, when Maine is the state, you know, talk about lobster, that's their state animal, I think, or something like that. And it's the Maine lobsters are, you know, just iconic. And then we talk about Maine. And you mentioned in the book that they don't like striped bass all that much up in Maine because they eat all the salmon and they eat all the lobsters.
That's right. That's right. They're not happy. Well, they're very happy. You want to go up there and fish for stripers. They're very happy to have you come and take them.
And take them. Yeah, right. Can't do that with the salmon. Yeah. One last thing I want to talk about. You talk a bit about the Hemingways, father and son, Ernest Hemingway, of course, iconic American author. And but his son, a lot of people don't know about him. One of his sons, Jack Hemingway, he wrote a book called Misadventures of a Fly Fisherman, I think it was.
Right.
I read that in college, and actually it turned me on to read even more Hemingway. I'd read Old Man and the Sea and maybe a few other books early on, but I started reading his father, Ernest Hemingway, quite a bit. I really enjoyed him. The more I found out about him, however, the later I got in life, I grew to kind of despise him. And then I was like, you know, how does Jack Hemingway, you know, he turns, Ernest Hemingway is this big braggadocio, turns into a big braggadocio sail fisherman and out in the Gulf Stream and stuff. But no, early on in life, he was a fly fisherman, and he taught his boys how to fly fish. And, you know, you talk about the big two-hearted river in there.
And it's one of my favorite stories in the book. So Jack decides he wants to fly fish.
Yeah.
And all Papa's great rivers. So he goes up to the two-hearted river and fishes, and he couldn't catch anything.
Yeah.
And he said to Papa, he said, you know, I tried the two-hearted river and I couldn't do anything. And Papa says, yeah, it's a lousy river for fishing. I just like the name.
It is a wonderful name, and it makes for a great story. But he, in that story, I think you talk about it. He's fishing with fly tackle, except he puts a grasshopper on the end of it.
It's really bait fishing.
Bait fishing. Bait fishing.
But he takes these grasshoppers and he fishes them like a fly, like an artificial fly. I don't know how that works. I've never seen that done.
I'm sure it can be done. It's light enough, I would imagine. I could probably do it, but.
But I think that is one of the great fishing stories.
Agreed, and it and I think you talk about you mentioned earlier here with us. You talk about like what river runs through it. It's like it doesn't tell you how to do it, but it tells you why.
Right.
And there's a lot of the why of why we're out there in nature, why we're out there with the fish, what it means to us, and I think we can all relate to that.
And one of the interesting things about that story is that character had PTSD. He had come back from the war, from World War One.
Right.
And he was going fishing almost as therapy.
It is therapy. That's why.
And we've since learned now it's a common practice thing to help veterans to take some fly fishing.
I have a friend of mine whose father was very involved with taking essentially wounded veterans and take them out on the river and just get them out there and go fishing for the day. And then it becomes a passion for life. And I think this book, I would just encourage our listeners to go out and get it, because it's one of these books. I whipped through it in no time flat. It's got wonderful illustrations, and they're very short essays that you can sit down and read one at a time or read the whole book at a time. But it's great just to have around, and you could even skip through and read any given one of these essays in no time flat. And it's just wonderful reading. And I just wanted to congratulate you on that.
Well, thank you. I had a great time writing it, I have to tell you. You know, it's something about just writing about things you love.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's the call to action for people. Go write and do things that you love doing, because it is sounds like really molded your life to be able to go and write about and do the things that you're passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to when you wade out in a river and you feel that current pushing against your legs, and you know that trout is out there waiting for you. It's just, there's no greater feeling.
Yeah, I agree. Mark, this has been wonderful. I know you got to bounce for another appointment. Big day for you. Launch of a new book, To Catch a Fish, by Story Publishing, March 31st, 2026. Any last words, Mark?
No, it's great talking to you. It's always great talking about fishing, isn't it?
it sure is. Yeah, I appreciate it. Hopefully keep in contact with you. There's a lot of stuff perhaps to talk about in the future with these new books coming out.
Yeah.
The re-release of Cod, which was, like I said earlier, a really transformative book for me.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Appreciate it, Mark.
Okay. Good talking to you.
Okay. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Mark talks about boxing in here in regards to The Quiet Man, the old John Wayne movie, and a short story by Morris Walsh, Irishman. So if you're tired of getting knocked out by the bare knuckle economy, guess what? I got two slots left this month, April, for a $297 platform domination consult. For more on that, go to briandeoleary.com/domination right now and secure your spot. That's briandeoleary.com/domination. Secure your spot before your competitors do.